Hey, folks, what a show we have for you today. Very excited about it, but I'm also very excited to tell you about the sponsor we're working with here over at Verbal Shenanigans. As we turn the corner from the cold, dreary winter into the warmer days of spring, a new season of fantasy baseball begins at DynastySportsEmpire.com. DynastySportsEmpire.com offers you a unique fantasy baseball experience for owners young and old and abilities of all levels. So what makes DSE unique? For starters, you can draft high school and international baseball phenoms as young as 16. You can retain ownership of your favorite players for their entire career and build a cash cow contender that would make any front office envious for years to come. Check out all the fantasy baseball formats over at DynastySportsEmpire.com today or tweet them at DSC Fantasy. That's at DSC Fantasy on Twitter or online at DynastySportsEmpire.com. All right, guys, let's get to today's episode.
Hey, guys, this is George Vitamin, the Universal Soldier, because I travel the world motorsport racing here at Verbal Shenanigans, mate. And I emphasize Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. We just keep going, going, going. We are the much
Energizer
lesser
bunny.
Yeah, the much lesser known version of the Energizer bunny. But
yeah, we're like those dollar store battery companies that had like a gorilla or something like that, but like everybody's like, I never saw that commercial, and we're like, yeah, it was on public access.
Yeah, that was us.
12 in the morning.
That was us
last Tuesday.
Yeah. So anyway, welcome back, everybody. If you're just tuning in, that is Mike. I am Scott, and this is episode like 354 or something like that. So if you don't like this episode, you can try 353 other ones, and there's got to be one that you kind of like.
Yeah, I mean, we're generous. Like, give us 247 tries minimum.
Right.
That's a good number, I think. I think it's a round number. I'm not sure if it's prime or not, but that, I mean, after 247, if you're like, man, all 247 suck, then goes listen to your Joe Rogans or whatever. But until you listen to 247, do not complain. Listen and subscribe.
Yeah, it's you know, like we're kind of like an acquired taste. You know, like some people like head cheese, and that takes a little while to get into. We're like the head cheese of the audio world.
My dad loved head cheese.
I tried head tried cheese. It. I tried head cheese.
You did?
A couple years ago, actually. I didn't try it when I was young. I had a coworker who brought it in who really liked it. I tried it. It was like, I don't know. It wasn't bad, but I would not sit there and tell you it was good either. It was kind of just like,
I always heard it's a texture thing more than anything.
Yeah, a little chewy, a little gelatinous. Taste was okay. Kind of like salty cheese, I guess it kind of tasted like, but it wouldn't be something I'm like, oh man, can't wait to have a head cheese sandwich today. Like, it just wasn't there.
So going back to a previous episode conversation, you're doing that big barbecue,
right?
And you're getting out all the burgers. You're saying Scott Brendan doesn't have a head cheese plan to provide enough head cheese to his guests.
You know, it always comes down to like, should I get guacamole and chips or a nice batch of head cheese? And I, you know, listen, Mike, I'm a poor comic here, and I don't have a lot of money, so I gotta always balance out the costs, you know, and usually the head cheese loses.
I figure avocados are way more expensive than head cheese. I can't fathom how much per pound head cheese could possibly be.
That's a great question, as I'm going to Google right now. How much is head cheese? What would your guess be?
I'm going to say, I mean, it's like pig brain. I'm going to say maybe a little exotic. I'm going to go $9.99 a pound.
Well, it's funny because the first one I typed in came up at $2.70.
I was well off on that prediction.
See, I would think it was more, though, too, because this guy brought in the head cheese. It was wrapped nicely. It looked like it was cut from, a butcher, kind of. So maybe that's the real cheap head cheese. I can't imagine. So here's, there's another one. Poche's Hog Head Cheese, $7.18. So now we're getting up there a little bit.
Now we're talking about some quality head cheese here. Yeah. I mean, these are the finest pigs they're ripping brains out of.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Boar's Head Cheese. Now, Boar's Head's got some good meat, right?
Oh, yeah.
From Instacart right now, you can get $6.99. Okay, so $7 you can get some head cheese.
Oh, all right. That's relatively in the same realm as your turkey and good hams and stuff like that.
But then on another page, it says $10.39 for some head cheese. So I don't really know. And then there's an advertisement for a head cheese throw pillow, if you're interested, Mike, for your basement, maybe.
I mean, I do have to replace some of this Redskin stuff that I still got down here, so that might work out, actually.
Can you imagine going on, bringing a girl home for the first time? You know, hey, why don't you come over my place for, a little bit of maybe some love and maybe some drinks. Mm-hmm. And then she sits down and you're like, oh, you could just move the head cheese pillow out of the way. Is there any chance of that night coming to fruition?
I think you got to play with it. I really think you do. It's just kind of I'm a little crazy and all.
You're really selling it, Mike. I'm a little crazy and all.
Yeah, I feel you might be a little crazy and stuff, babe. You know, what are we going to do with this tonight, you know? I mean, you see my head cheese pillow. Whatever happens, it's going to be unpredictable. So why don't we just go with it, you know?
And this is why you were single for a long time, right?
Yes, very long time. Very long time. I had my head cheese pillow. I had my glass head with the beads in it that you destroyed on my 40th birthday party. Then my whole single life was just ruined, you know.
I mean, I think it comes down to the name, right? If it was named something else, I don't know, maybe it was called Major Cheese or Beauty Cheese, people would be more open to having it. When you call it head cheese, it just doesn't have a good connotation. Right away, you're like, I'm not eating head cheese.
Yeah. They should come up with fun names or something, like knowledge chewing or something like that. Because, you're eating the brain. That's where all the knowledge is. I mean, you can come up with this whole backstory of like ancient scientists thought that eating the brain of a pig made their IQ go up. I mean, people buy anything anyway. I mean, they probably had those little pills at the front of the Krausers, that says, oh, I'm going to perform better than ever and be 10 times bigger. Okay. So.
Yeah. So it's traditionally made from chopped and boiled pig's head. So right away, that's a hard sell, which is then formed into a jellied loaf, which is another hard sell.
Jellied loaf right there. Now you need the best salesman on the planet to sell that thing.
Yeah. Many people believe calling it cheese makes it sound more appetizing, especially to those who squirm at the thought of eating a pig's head. Now, I have eaten a pig's eyeball before. I told this on the cast. Mm-hmm. We were having a party where we roasted a pig. Delicious, by the way. Delicious when you roast a pig. But, I'm a big proponent of eating the whole pig. The whole animal's there, and mm-hmm. there may or may not have been a couple beverages involved in this decision. But it was it was kind of a dare thing. Oh, I'll eat the pig butt. I'll have the pig hoof. And then I was you know what? I'll eat the pig eye. And we tried it. A little crunchy.
It's always kind of weird what we proclaim as this is okay,
right,
and this is you kind of things. You know what I mean? It's
right.
like when we talk about the jowls of the pig, I mean, that's still good. You talk about the tongue of the pig, they're like, oh, that's gross. And it's kind of just killed an animal and chopped it up. Are we going to really deal with the semantics of what part of the pig I'm putting in my mouth?
The pig brain wasn't bad. The pig brain just tastes like scrambled eggs. It wasn't like great, but it wasn't bad. The eye, the eye was pretty gnarly. Like it wasn't good. In fact, I did not really swallow it at all. So,
I mean, as long as you didn't put pineapple on top of it, I'm fine with it.
Yeah, whatever, man. Pineapple and pizza, you know, grow a little. Can you order for me, please, a pineapple and jalapeno pizza? I think you will enjoy it. You get the sweet and the sour and the spicy.
When we get together, whenever these days, whether it's Jersey or Georgia, sometime in the future.
Yeah, isn't it crazy?
We will obtain this pizza and try it out. I just tell you from my experience, I feel pineapple, it's not bad, but it overpowers everything else where it doesn't come out that great. I prefer a lighter fruit, like an apple or a pear.
Wait. Whoa. So you prefer apple pizza?
I told you on the cast before, when we go to Mellow Mushroom, which is kind of a chain down here, but I think it's pretty national, that one. It's like above like the Pizza Huts and all that.
All right, let me get this straight. When you do mushrooms, after you do mushrooms, you go and you get apple pizza.
No. Here's what's on it. It's apple.
Okay.
It's candy pecans and it's ham.
See, I would try that. See, I have no problem evolving. Yeah, I have no
problem
with that.
That's delicious. And it's lesser on the sweet. You get the salty ham. That's all good. I'm saying pineapple overpowers everything where I can't taste everything. And I just feel like I'm basically eating a pizza dessert.
Isn't it crazy that we have not seen each other now in like 3 years? We have not been in the same room for like 3 years.
It's been a while.
That's a weird thing because it used to be like, I would see you we'd go do some dumb show or some dumb mic or something like that. Mm-hmm. We would get together for the podcast. We would get together for the other radio show. And then we'd get together for like a football game. Often we would go like watch a game or you'd come over and watch a game. It's pretty interesting. We have not seen each other in 3 years. And I think that's a streak now. We're working on a streak of not seeing each other.
Oh, so like, if we don't see each other for the rest of our lives, like, we can, like, virtual high-five each other. It's like, yeah, we broke some weird record that nobody really challenged.
We did 5,000 episodes without ever being in the same room, you know?
Yeah.
it is kind of wild to think about. Like, you know, I guess with, like, even, like, the pandemic and stuff, like, everything. Like, we started doing the digital thing well before that when you moved. But even with that now, I don't see my I saw my friends for the first time last Saturday. We went to like an outdoor beer garden kind of thing. And I hadn't seen them in a year. But I had seen them more than I ever did with like we did a Friday night Zoom call. Almost every Friday, the entire pandemic. So I feel like I'm closer to my friends now than ever, which is kind of like a double-edged sword, right? Like you don't want to be like, man, like I see my friends all the time through a computer screen, but it is a cool way to kind of keep in touch with people at the same time.
I mean, it's just a product of the time. I mean, if it's like 3 years from now and that's the only way you see your friends, it's kind of like, all right, this gets old. And then you're kind of like, oh, I don't think I can do next Friday. Then it's something like you appear once a month and it's like,
yeah. Things start to taper off a little bit. Yeah. I don't know. It's so we were talking about head cheese. What is like the most exotic food you've shoved down your gullet?
That is an interesting question.
I've tried gator, I've tried shark, I tried buffalo, which is I don't think is a good
idea. I've done deer, I've done deer, squirrel. I've never done squirrel.
What's squirrel like?
I mean, it's all right. I mean, it's a little game. It was a long time ago. I think I told a story on the podcast where, like, my dad took me hunting for the first time, and he shot two squirrels, and me being an animal lover, hunting wasn't my thing, so we go up to the dead squirrel and just start bawling, and then he's like, well, you know, we can just leave the squirrels here, and I'm like, no, they're already dead, and being the good animal lover that I am, I still ate the squirrel that night.
Well, isn't that a funny point? Like, it's a super hypocritical point that we all have, right? We're animal lovers, but we don't want to hunt. But yet we'll go down the road to the ShopRite or whatever and grab some burgers that are packaged from some facility.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the fact that we look down on hunters as a society, I don't anymore, especially. Maybe when I was younger, I thought of it. But they are the ones keeping it alive, like keeping factory farming somewhat at bay. But like, we sit there and we judge that. And yet we'll go get our meat from some nice package that where it's just a slaughterhouse packing it in there.
Oh yeah, and they treat those animals horrible. Like I never shun people hunting. I'll look down if they kill the animal and all they do is like get a trophy out of it. That's right. Kind of like, okay, now you just, that's a douchey kind of kill.
Totally.
But as much as I'm like, oh, I can't do that, I can't fathom ever becoming vegan or anything like that. I actually, my one ex-girlfriend, when the stories broke on KFC, their farms, it was KFC or Purdue, one of them, where like they were kicking the chickens and like stomping on their heads and stuff like that. Like, she went veggie because of that.
Did you ever see Super Size Me 2?
Yes, I watch it.
That was good. It was another one, like where they grow the chickens so freaking big they can't walk. They're just basically, they're like meat plants, like plants, literally. Like they sit there and just grow. It's bad, man. I mean, and like, we all try to be like, you know, a little involved and conscious. But when it comes down to it, we're not that much. We still go to the food store and load our fridge up with meat, and then we go out to eat. We have no idea where our food's coming from. So I applaud hunters, man. But it's like we all want to make a difference. But when it's 6 o'clock, 6:30, 7 o'clock after work, and we gotta get something on the grill and eat before bed, it kind of goes out the window.
I mean, I will honestly say, like, in this environment, I can't fathom a time where I could become veggie or vegan.
Right.
But if this pandemic took a really bad turn and like society was destroyed, I couldn't fathom myself going out there with a big old knife cutting up a cow and cooking it up. So I'd probably be eating bean sprouts then.
What's an animal that you would want to try that you've never tried? Like, what's an animal you're like, it's pretty tasty that I've never had?
I think I never had alligator. I've always heard that's good. I can't remember if I had ostrich. I can't remember if I had a buffalo burger or an ostrich burger. That's always been
two big extremes. White meat, dark meat.
Yeah. I kind of want to, it's weird as it sounds, try bear. And I don't know why.
I agree with that.
I've heard like it's super gamey and like you got to cook it a proper way because they have parasites in there. But, it's just something like you can just brag, even though like somebody else killed it, prepared it, cooked it, where you can still like feel kind of manly where you go, I ate bear last night.
I would eat it in 2 seconds as long as it's prepared and was shot by somebody and they, you know, it was butchered correctly. I would definitely eat it. I mean, you go get a freaking burger at McDonald's. You have no idea where that weird, lightly textured meat has been. Yeah, I would totally try bear meat. I feel like it's kind of a manly thing, and like, I don't know, like bears are widely hunted, so there's got to be a lot of good bear chefs out there. Bear chefs.
Can you imagine like going outside to like a barbecue and you just see a huge freaking grizzly bear on a spit? Just getting circled around on a fire.
Well, it's a spit, Berlew. I don't know. I don't know if you see a grizzly bear on a spit. That seems a little weird, but
well, whatever. On the bar that circles, okay?
Yeah. The circle bar.
You don't know what I mean.
The circle bar.
Yeah.
All right. If you were offered human cooked really well, like someone knew how to prepare a human, would you do it? Would you taste a human?
No, because right off the bat, I wouldn't trust the person trying to offer me that meat. So,
what if it was like Bobby Flay? He's like, look, it's a new niche restaurant I have down in the village where we're just serving human. They all donated their bodies to us. They were former chefs. I prepared it with a nice chimichurri sauce. It's a little spicy. It's a little it's braised just right. You wouldn't take a spoonful of it?
Nah, it seems like the downward path and all, where somebody's going to be, there'll be like backdoor human restaurants and stuff like that, where it'll be like, well, this is weird. The homeless problems seem to have gone away down here, kind of deals.
It might be a good way to get rid of the homeless, like a survival tournament, you know, and then like whoever wins cooks all his opponents.
What was that movie with Ice-T where he was getting hunted? You remember that one?
With Ice-T? I don't know.
It was a really good movie. I think it... I want to say playing the game, but let me see.
Yeah, never heard of it. I think prepared right and prepared... and I know that the body is not a dead person. I might try human. Like... I mean, their body is a person that donated their body to this cause. I might try some human, like a human short rib, probably delicious, like a fat marbled guy.
Now, would you have human head cheese?
Ugh, got it. Considering what I see on social media, I'm not trying anybody's head cheese. I feel like that's how it starts. Like you eat some head cheese from some TikToker, and before you know it, I'm vlogging and... I'm an influencer. Like, I don't want that life.
You don't feel like, I mean, in the gelatinous goo that somebody can come up with a good recipe?
I mean, I feel like anything could probably taste good. Like, I don't like mushrooms and I don't really like broccoli, but I've had that stuff in things and I don't mind it. But by themselves, I'm like, yuck. So human brain, human calf by itself, probably gross. But in a nice gumbo... I'll take it.
On a side note, it was called Surviving the Game. Had Gary Busey in it.
So it had... So you're billing this movie as Gary Busey and Ice-T? That was the top billing in that movie?
Let's see. Rucker Hauer. Let's see. Charles S. Dutton. Who else is there? John C. McClaney.
John Cena?
McGinley.
Oh.
John from Scrubs.
Right.
Gotcha. That was a damn good movie.
I gotta check that out.
That was one that got lost in the shuffle. That definitely, if you like hunting humans, you'll love Surviving the Game.
But what about barbecuing humans and serving them with a nice aioli? Is there a movie for that yet?
I'm sure there's one out there. I think I remember a movie called Parents where Dennis Quaid was it Dennis or Randy Quaid was like the parent, and they were like this suburban family with an adopted kid, and they were basically murdering people and they were like cannibals and stuff.
I have no idea, but it's definitely guest time. So
that was the best segue possible to our guest.
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty much masters of this at the moment. So we had a guest on, Tammy Lane, the first guest of the year, actually. She was phenomenal. And she recommended this guest to us. She said he's a one-of-a-kind guy to talk to. He's a racer, and he loves guns, and he's just a real treat to talk to. And she did not lie, okay, because... we had George Vidovic on the show, and he is a Cobra racer. He's been working on cars for his entire life. He's originally from Australia. I could talk to this guy for hours, and I'm sure we can get him back on to talk more. But Python racing enthusiast, gun lover. I don't know what else you can say about him besides just listen to this interview coming up. So here's our interview with George Vidovic.
Is that you?
You made it. You did it.
Hold on, Jesus Christ. I'm fucking amazed that I did it, mate.
I had faith in you this whole time it was going to go down. I knew it.
Well, I'm glad you fucking did, because I didn't have faith in me, I'll tell you now, mate. Jesus.
I knew it. I said, if this guy can work on race cars, he can figure out how to click the Zoom button. I knew it.
I knew you were going to say that, mate. I was just about to say, I drive 200-mile-an-hour cars and I can't do technology, let me tell you.
Well, you can't get on a Zoom call while you're driving, so I can understand where the experience is lost. So.
He can now.
I tried. Hey, listen, guys, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. George, you came as a recommendation from our friend Tammy Lane a couple months ago, who we had on the cast, who we very much love to talk to, and she said, I gotta recommend this guy George. He is Python racing, but he's also just a very interesting, unique guy. So I'm excited to finally sit down and talk to you. So thanks a lot, man.
No, you're more than welcome, mate. You know, one of my favorite words is shenanigans. It can be applied to everything, mate.
It can. So George,
except for entertainment, as we
found out. except for interesting interviews.
That's it, mate.
So let me ask you: you're in California now. You're originally from Australia. How does a guy make that journey from Australia to, you know, in California? You drive all over the country. Where did you start this whole racing career, in Australia, or was that something that you started in America?
Well, listen, mate, I think I'm going to make your ears bleed here if you've got time for me, I'll tell you now. Look, the journey started in 1976.
Right.
One of the things that happened to me in 76 is I went to a drive-in in Melbourne with a group of mates. You guys call them drive-ins, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yep. Yeah, go for a drive, yeah.
Yep. No. Drive-ins as in the cinema where you go.
Oh, drive-ins. Theater.
Yep.
Drive-in theater, yeah. We went to a drive-in theater in 76. It was summer. We reversed our panel vans with the back facing. Panel vans are shagging wagons, you guys call them. Right. So We're at the picture. Yeah. So we had a couple of shagging wagons. We had some girls there and we're just checking out the vibe of the pictures. And we went and saw this movie called Gumball Rally, G-U-M-B-A-L-L, Gumball Rally, made in about 76. And I saw this blue car go crazy across the screen. I thought, what the fuck is that car? It just blew my mind. You know, I had no idea. And sort of left the cinema that night a little bit impressed by this car. And I'm going, this car's really stifled or whet my appetite to find out what the hell it is. Because back in the early 70s, I was doing engineering at university and I was very much a British sports car guy, like the MGBs, like Alfa Romeos, like Jaguars, Aston Martins, never really followed any of the American muscle car genre and really didn't know much about it, you know?
Right.
Lo and behold, you know, fast forward a couple of months and I get this magazine and I discovered that the car I saw on screen was an AC Cobra. So I don't, you know, the story's quite intense and quite long and I don't want to really drag it out for you guys because I'm a bit concerned about a timeline, so to speak, but hence to say that instilled this passion of an AC Cobra. I got involved in V8s, started discovering that V8s were a lot faster than four cylinders, right. You know, for obvious reasons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ended up driving a V8 a mate had, and it just converted me. It just blew my mind, you know. I took it out on the highway in Melbourne in North Road. It just finished raining. I went through first and second gear and I was fishtailing down the main highway, first, second and third gear with this V8. And I said, holy shit, what is this thing they call V8, you know?
Yeah.
So it scared the living bejesus out of me. And I thought, Jesus Christ, I got to learn more about it. Anyway, moving forward, about 1979, I built my first AC Shelby Cobra replica. Didn't quite know what I had, advertised it in a newspaper saying selling Shelby replica kit cars, and the phone just went wild on Saturday. I probably got, without exaggerating, 50 phone calls from 9 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the afternoon going, where can we buy one? Where can we see one? And it just went crazy. You know, that was 79. I then built a car. I finished building the car, displayed it at the International Melbourne Motor Show back in, I think, 84. And the response, again, was just overwhelming. You know, this 22-year-old guy selling an AC Shelby Cobra replica sports car in Australia was just unheard of. So I was pretty brash and in-your-face type of bloke. And I was a bit like a dog with a bone. I just wouldn't let it go. And I thought, fuck this, I'm going to make this happen. And hence the journey started with the sports car genre, you know?
Yeah.
So going forward a little bit, you know, what I found is I had to create to feed the animal, so to speak, to build AC Cobras, to have a manufacturing plant and kits and molds made and chassis and all that. I started GMB Performance and GMB Chrome Shop, which was an automotive business that was making money daily, that started funding Python Vehicles Australia to build Cobra replicas, because I wasn't selling too many kits. I was still a little bit naive, didn't know, got taken for a ride by a couple of guys fabricating bits and pieces for me. So there was that naivety in me that took some people took me for a ride, you know, because of it.
Right.
You know, so the business grew. We started building cars. We actually, you know, one of my feathers in a hat that I like telling people is we actually built a car for Michael Schumacher, the Formula One ace, the guy who had that skiing accident.
Yep.
So we built a car for Michael and shipped it to Switzerland. So one of the things, and he chose our car over any other Cobra replica in the world, including the famous Shelby Incorporated factory in Vegas. Right. We were chosen to build him a car. So I was... That just humbled me like you wouldn't believe, guys.
That's awesome.
You
know? I can imagine.
So, you know, going through that journey in Australia was quite difficult. Australia, God, you know, one of the most difficult things in Australia is to build motor cars, because we have what they call ADRs, Australian Design Rules. And because of manufacturing in Australia, the Australian government don't care how small you are. They don't care how big you are. They have a set of guidelines that you have to follow, regardless of who you are. So being a small volume car builder, I had to comply with all the design rules that Ford, GM, Toyota, Mitsubishi, Mercedes-Benz had to. Emission control, intrusion bars in the doors, inertia reel, seat belts, three wipers instead of two wipers. We had to torsion and beam test the chassis. We had to do brake tests. We had to comply the rims, and on went the list. It was just...
Sounds easy. Sounds really easy.
Mate, it was absolute madness, Scotty. You know, I can't begin to tell you the problem is you would test your chassis in July, you'd get certification of the chassis in July, you'd sell a chassis in August, September, then in November a new design rule came through that didn't pass your chassis from July. Yeah. So you had to retest the chassis all over again. So it was that constant pushing me that drives me to telling you what happened, how I got here. I was also the chairman of Specialty Vehicles Australia for about 15 years. That was an organisation that lobbied the state and federal government for changes in the automotive industry. My organisation basically worked for the mom and pop shops in America, in Australia. Like, for example, Scott, if you had a small manufacturing plant, your company might have been making 50 small door buttons for Ford Australia. Right. So we were working with you guys to keep you supplying Ford and helping you whatever you needed. And I'm using that as a small example.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was a constant battle. So what would happen is there would be a particular politician that would be in power, and I would lobby him. And I would take him out to race meetings, and I would bring him to workshops, and I'd show him places. And he was, he'd be a fantastic ally because he's into sports cars. All of a sudden, he gets voted out, and Michael, the greenie, gets voted in. And now I've got to start all over again. And it just so happens Michael rides his bicycle to work, doesn't like petrol engines, believes in the environment. So he goes, George, we're on different paths here. So that was the battle I was fighting for 15 years.
Huh. Yeah, sorry about that. It's just the way I grew up. I'm sorry.
Michael, I came to God's country, mate. This is God's country, mate. Don't ever forget that. This is God's country. Mm. Petrol, engines, motorcycles, and guns. What can a man ask for, mate? You know? You know, here, this is the one that you're going to love. And I mean, I'm a little bit frightened in telling you the honest to godness story because of, you know, the podcast and all that. God bless you. But this is actually what happened. So during the course of me lobbying, I invite a politician and two of his cohorts to my workshop in South Melbourne. Now, my workshop in South Melbourne, to give you an idea of the location, to give you an idea of the ambience of the place, it was a 6,000 square foot funhouse museum with eclectic collections. We had one arm bandits. I had 4,000 model cars on display. We had a coffee shop with an old 1970s coffee machine in the corner. Nice. We served people with coffees. We had a small showroom. We ran Python Choppers motorcycle business that created and engineered motorcycles and built motorcycles. We had GV Automotive that serviced cars. We had Python vehicles that restored cars, everything from $50,000 restorations to $1.5 million restorations. And then we had the Python Racing division that started back in 1997, which I haven't spoken much about, but I will tell you.
Yeah, we'll get to that for sure.
Unfolds to that, you know. So, this workshop, to give you an idea of where it was, if you stood on the roof of my building and you turned to the right, you would see downtown Melbourne. If you turned to the left, you would see the ocean, the beach.
Nice.
So I was 5 minutes drive from the beach and I was 5 minutes drive from the CBD. It was basically a blue ribbon golden mile location called South Melbourne. The casino is 3 minutes drive from my building. So it was unheard of to have a sports car manufacturing building and business in that location because it was so blue, white collar, if you know what I mean, as far as location. Mm-hmm. The land was worth more than the actual business was, if that makes sense, you know?
Wow, yeah.
So I thought, perfect environment, invite the guys down. So I got this guy down. Now, I don't want to mention names and I don't want to mention the politicians' names because I don't want to get into any sort of trouble, if you know what I mean, guys. Yep. But this is, you know, this really happened. So we get him down. I walk him through the shop and I'm showing him all the different departments. And I'm showing him what we're doing and how we're creating jobs for people. I had 11 guys working for me, building everything from motorcycles to hot rods to racing cars to old vintage sports cars. Covered all spectrums. The only thing we didn't do is we didn't paint and we didn't do upholstery. We did everything else. Wow. So he basically then turns around and he goes, listen, George, you know, what is it that I can do for you? What is it exactly that, you know, your organization and you want? And I said, well, look, you know, I'll call him Frank. Listen, Frank, what I want is, and I understand that we can't change laws. We can't introduce new laws because they're going to take a lot longer to implement because they've got to go through all these political circumstances as far as going to different houses and all that sort of stuff. But what I ask from you guys is, we want to make laws that will apply to us or relax certain laws and work with us on what we need to achieve building cars a little bit easier because they're on smaller volume, you know? So we don't want you to change any laws, but we want you to work with us to see what you can to help us not apply certain laws to our vehicles because we're not a high-volume manufacturer. And he basically turned around to me and he goes, you know, George, I understand where you're coming from, but at the end of the day, you know, the law is the law in Australia. And if you feel that you can't have your vehicles comply to Australian standards, what you should do is build your vehicles for the export market and maybe export to the United States or other countries. Hold on, boys. So I turned around to him and said, is that right, Frank? I said, listen, mate, the first and foremost thing that I want you to understand, mate, is I want to build an Australian-built car and sell it to Australians first and foremost because I need to understand that I want my Aussies to enjoy my product before I look at exporting, and I need to know that I can create a cash flow so that I can have the volume to export. So what you're telling me is not going to work. And he goes, well, you know, the law's the law, George. And I said, is that right? Well, let me play you a little fucking scenario, Frank. Let me play a little scenario. This is what I'm going to do, mate. So if I turned around and sacked all my 11 workers, sold all my assets that might equate to $10, $11 million, go to the Reserve Bank, which is the biggest bank in Australia that handles all Australian Commonwealth funding, and say, I want my 11 million. It's my money, not yours, Scott, not yours, Michael. It's my fucking money. I want it in a suitcase in cash. I want you guys to get a security escort for me to the airport. I'm going to then jump on an airplane with my cash, fly to the United States. When I get to the United States, Frank, and I get to border and customs control, and they turn around to me and say, well, Mr. Vidovic, welcome to the United States. What are you declaring? The first thing I'll say to them, Frank, is I'm declaring $11 million cash in these suitcases. And I bet you know what they're going to say, Frank? They're going to say, God bless you, Mr. Vidovic. Welcome to the United States of America. Now, the next thing I tell you is the thing that is the straw that broke the camel's back with me. He turns around to me and he says to me in front of all my workers, and all my workers scattered because I know what I'm like. I'm pretty fucking intense in the best of times. He turned around to me and said, George, don't be so melodramatic. And I said, oh, is that right? Scotty, Michael, I'm going to tell you something right now, and I swear on my mother, she's 6 feet deep. I got on the phone that night to a guy that was hassling me to buy my building for the last 6 years, and I sold the building the next night. Wow. I then sold the building. The story of selling the business is insane in its own right. So yeah, you can imagine what I had to try to sell. And I tried to take it to, I was going to take it at an auction, and I had friends saying, don't take the auction. You're going to sell some stuff. You're not going to sell other stuff. It's going to go into storage and it's going to be really hard. And what had happened is that one of the manufacturers that was manufacturing the chassis for us on contract buys the company off me. So from the time from August, I was landed in America with my race car, equipment, spare parts, spare panels, tools, and a few bits of machinery, October 17th, 2017.
Okay, so not too long ago.
No. Nah.
Huh. So you didn't vote for George in the next election? I just want to clarify.
No comment, mate. I voted for Ronald Reagan, mate. I mean, that's the journey, and it's a quick one telling you guys because of timeline. Mm. That's the journey that it took me to get here. However, I need to let you understand that I've been traveling to the United States since 1980.
Okay.
So I had things in place here, unbeknownst to me, that I was going to move here part-time, because we were traveling backwards and forwards. We were buying motorcycles out of Tennessee. We were driving from Flint, Michigan down to the Florida Keys, and with a 5-ton box trailer, and buying motorcycle parts and engine parts. And so I crossed this country. I've probably done 25, 30, 40,000 miles in running around, going to the most amazing, crazy outposts that I can't, Falmouth, Kentucky, with two ex-Vietnam vets running the good old boys motorcycle shop in, Falmouth, Kentucky. I mean, crazy shit, Awesome. It was wild, mate.
Wow. Wild story. Let's talk a little bit about your racing career. So you actually raced your cars. You won a championship as a driver 3 times and once as a crew chief. Kind of take us through, the difference between making your cars and enjoying them and they're fast to making them and need to compete on a track and passing people and so forth. Where does that change?
Yeah, look, that story in Python Racing's inception was insane. I mean, one of the reasons I started was to give our street cars credibility, so to speak. That was more one of the reasons that I wanted. I had never driven a race car in my life. I'd never driven a go-kart. I've never been on a racetrack. So I've been thrown basically straight from the frying pan straight into the fire by jumping in a 340 horsepower, AC Shelby Cobra replica called the Python that we built in 1996. And it just scared the living bejesus out of me to the point where I'll tell you an experience, mate. We created the business, we created the race team, we put the necessary people in place to help us, guys that knew that were from other teams. And I said to Maggie, I don't think I want to get a driver. I think I want to drive the car. I think I'm capable of doing, we went to a couple of race meetings to have a look and see what everyone else was doing and to see how fast everyone else was. And at this particular time, that the actual class and the eligibility of the car was, the class was called Mark, M-A-R-Q-U-E, sports cars. So it was different marks, you know, MG, Datsun, TVR, cars of that caliber, of that genre, cars based from, say, 1960 to 1976, 1979, sports cars of that era. So that was called Mark Sports. I eventually lobbied the CAMS, Confederation of Australian Motorsport, to accept my car because they wouldn't accept it because they're saying it was a replica and it wasn't a true manufactured sports car, that it was a reproduction of an existing car. So that took me, that took 18 months just to lobby that organisation to get the car FIA approved as a sports car to its own entity. That's why we called it the Python SR302, because one of my arguments was if we took the body off the chassis, presented the chassis with all the running gear to the tech officers to inspect it, would you call it an AC Cobra replica or would you call it a Python? So that argument went down quite well. And they said, well, you're absolutely right. It doesn't matter on the silhouette of the body of the vehicle.
Right.
It's the construction of the mechanicals that makes the car what it really is, apart from what it looks like.
Right.
So I won that, you know. So we decide, we build the car, we test it, we think, oh, it's really cool, I can do this. We go to Phillip Island. Let me tell you, man, I'm not embarrassed to say it. We go out Friday morning, I do three laps. On the third lap, Phillip Island is one of the most internationally renowned motorsport venues in the world because they run the MotoGP there, as you guys would know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an amazing track, very fast corners, very fast main straights, very long straights going into turn one, two and Southern Loop up through Siberia, the back straight down to Lukey Heights. Anyway, so on the third lap, I'm up at Lukey Heights, which is the back straight coming down into MG Corner, which brings you onto the main straight, and I throw a rod through the side of the block. Now, the first two laps, I didn't know what gear I was in. Cars were buzzing past me. I didn't know how fast it was going. I shit myself like I cannot tell you the fear of me. I can't explain to you the word fear. You can read it in the dictionary, but unless you've experienced it face on, you won't understand what fear is, guys. I am telling you, man. I am telling you. You know, so they tow the car back, and I was that scared that I jump into our support vehicle and I drive off. And Maggie's chasing the car. My wife, who's been my crew chief for 21 years and has won me the three championships, is running after the car, jumps in the car, and I'm not saying a word, and I'm off. And I've left the track. I've left the car there. I've left the team there. I've left the trailer there. I've left everything there, guys. You can't. You just could imagine. And the phone rings, and they're talking to Maggie, and Maggie's going, it's okay. You guys pack up. We'll meet you back at the workshop. No problems. And we're driving, and we're about 10 miles out of the track. I pull over, and I said, Maggie, I can't do this. I was so frightened that I didn't know what gear I was in. I didn't know what apexes were. I didn't know what brake markers were. I can't do this. And, you know, she turned around to me and she said, you know what, George? She goes, you haven't given yourself a chance and there's no way that we've spent this sort of money and you're not going to try it again.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the journey that I started with. And, you know, and a lot of things happened on the way.
Of course.
We introduced the second car. You know, we then built a second car that we turned it into a two-car team. And one of the proud things I've got to say to you guys from an American point of view and an Australian point of view is, and I'm, dare I be very careful in saying this, I'm probably the only manufacturer in the world that owned a two-car factory race team that was driven by the owner, operator, and manufacturer of the car.
Yeah.
Carroll Shelby didn't do it in the 50s or the 60s.
Right.
No one really did it. I was the only guy that in automotive history, and only because I'm a nobody that people don't know this, but that I'm the only guy that did it. We ran two cars. We ran them successfully. I won the championship first year out in 98. That was the year that we blew that engine. I got scared. I got on top of it. I grabbed it by the scruff of the neck and I said, you know, fuck this. I haven't spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and not enjoy the product that I've built and I've brought to the forefront. And we won the championship in 98. Now, to tell you honestly, we never pulled a checkered flag. We finished second, third, every race. We were consistent Our points constantly climbed.
Gotcha.
The cars that won didn't finish the second race. They didn't finish the third race. But we finished every race and we won on points, which is, hey, to me, I'll take it any day of the week, guys.
Absolutely.
Now, now, Mike's a big race fan. He's a big NASCAR fan. You know, I know you do the Python racing. Did you ever venture into other types of racing? Like, did that interest you? Or was it, are you just like, is your heart just in the Python and you are Python?
Well, yeah, I get you, Scotty. Look, I didn't venture into other racing, but that you know, it's amazing you say this. What happened was that the motor racing opened so many doors for me. I mean, prior to 97, prior to racing, you know, no one wanted to talk to a brash young guy running around in a Harley Davidson with an earring building sports cars for $150,000. And who the hell does he think he is? And we're not going to spend that sort of money with this young kid. He's a gangster and he's this and it's that. That really was a problem in the early years of my life because, you know, I'm 6'4". I'm not a shy guy. I'm in your face. I'm not scared of telling you that, you know, a spade is a spade. You know, nothing sort of, if something's wrong, I'll tell you it's wrong. So it was hard to shake that image that people that people saw in me.
Mm-hmm.
When I started motor racing, I had famous race car drivers, you know, John Bauer. These are all Australian guys that most of you guys wouldn't know, but these guys ran the V8 supercar series. These guys that ran in V8 supercars that are historic race all over the world. You know, John Bauer started saying, "Hey, George, how you going, mate?" You know, Alan Moffat would walk up to my pits and say, "Oh, the car's going well." So, you know, Jimmy Carter and all these guys that were racing at that time started going, "Oh, this guy puts his money where his mouth is. Let's go and talk to him." So all of a sudden, different doors were opening. I was going and seeing different race teams. I was passionate for the Python, Scott, because it was my baby.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I didn't want to let it go, mate. It was my baby. I didn't want to jump in any other car. You know, I was offered drives in Mercedes-Benzes. I was offered drives in Porsches. But I was racing against those guys, and they're the guys that I wanted to beat. So why the hell would I go and jump in an opposition's car? It's like saying to Carol Shelby, "Hey, Carol, we don't think your car's fast enough, but Ferrari wants you to drive his car." He'd tell him where to go, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what it did do for me, guys, is it started giving me notoriety within the industry. I started getting a name in the industry, and I started having young drivers approach me to drive my car. They actually, you know, and they paid me for the opportunity to drive my car.
Nice.
Well, I mean, it works that way. When you're an up-and-coming young driver and you want to make a name for yourself, you're going to buy drives in different teams to prove to higher teams that you've got what it takes. So they'll try to win championships for you and then say, "Hey, Scotty, I know you've got a NASCAR team in Mooresville. I'd like to drive for you. I just won a championship for George last year." And then they'll ring me and say, "Hey, George, what's this guy Christian DeGosten like? You know, is he quick? Is he, what's his mentality? What's his temperament?" So that's that sort of credibility that I ended up getting within the racing fraternity so much. And I mean, to this day, I've got guys, you know, keeping in touch with me on Facebook. "Oh, we're watching your racing. It's really cool, George. You're doing well. You're taking it to the Yanks, blah, blah, blah." But to be honest with you guys, you know, my bucket list here is, I mean, what I want to do is I want to race at every racetrack that is in the United States. That's my bucket list.
Nice.
Now, whether I win or not, I've won championships, so I don't have to prove the car anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've got to remember, guys, I'm driving from the pocket now because the buck stops with me and I pay all the bills. So if I fuck the car, I've got to fix the car.
Yeah.
George, you're so passionate about cars, and you also, we didn't touch on Python choppers as well. I've been saying to a lot of people, back in the day, they made cars.
Yeah.
Now they just make automobiles. It's nothing that's really made today is something like 30 years from now, somebody's going to go, "Oh my God, I got to have that." I would kind of want to get your thoughts on like the industry as a whole.
Wow. you know, Mike, you got to be careful with me because you'll open up a can of worms when it comes to the automotive industry as a whole. You know,
way to go, Mike. Way to go.
Sorry, you know,
here it comes.
First, I took down his place in Australia. Now this, I apologize.
Well, yeah, look, going back to Australia quickly, Mike. You know, we've lost Ford. They've left the country. No more manufacturing of Ford motor cars in Australia. We've lost GM. They've left the country. Lost Mitsubishi. We've lost Nissan. We've lost all those companies. And we've lost those companies for one reason: dollars. It's too expensive to build in the United States, in Australia. We've got unions that we have to tackle. Wages are too high. Exports too high because we're so far away. So, you know, that it became such an economic thing when it came to larger organizations like Ford, GM and Mitsubishi and Toyota and companies of that caliber basically looked at the bottom line being the dollar. Today's manufacturing is just, to me, it's lost its passion. It's lost its soul. The biggest word for me is soul. Cars had soul in the 50s and 60s. People built them look, I'm getting goosebumps. You can't see it, but I'm getting goosebumps, guys. When the 56 T-Bird was designed and when the 57 Chev was designed and when the GDO Pontiac was designed, they were designed for the guy would sit down in front of his drawing board with his pencil and say, you know, I want to design a car where I can drive my girlfriend down the boulevard and people will turn their heads and go, wow, that's a cool car, man. I want that car. And if I get that car, I'll have the same girl that guy's got in the passenger seat. I mean, that's what it was about, mate. It was the sound of the car. It was cars doing burnouts. It was people living dreams that they couldn't fulfill any other way than but buying a car. Cars today don't, for God's sake, guys, I'm driving LA and what the hell do I see every day? Bloody Teslas, they're driving me nuts.
I was going to ask you about those.
Mate, don't even go there with electric cars with me. You know what? You and me are going to die of old age by the time they introduce electric cars into this world in a full-time basis. It ain't going to happen, mate.
Yep.
Because the environment can't control the electric surge that the electric cars need to be fed. And I mean, I can't jump in my electric car and drive from LA to New York in one go. Let me rephrase that. I can't drive my electric car from, say, LA to Phoenix in one petrol tank. I've got to stop or I've got to charge it somewhere. It's just not practical. As a city vehicle, sure. If you want to drive around LA, you want to drive from Santa Monica to Santa Monica Pier or to Malibu, knock yourself out in your electric car. You know, wear your skirt and your little flip-flops and look like the girl in Fancy and feel really, really genetically happy and gay within yourself. Not that there's anything wrong with being gay, but I'm just saying, I'm just using that as a word as being happy, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so the automotive industry has got a lot to answer to. It needs to bring people, the young generation need to come on board and be passionate about what they put down on paper, not so much paper, but on the computer screen.
Right.
Don't be scared, you know. Don't be scared about creating a car with ergonomics because, you know, it's got to go through a wind tunnel in a particular way because it doesn't need to use that much fuel or it's got to conserve fuel. And so when you look at cars today, to answer you, Michael, they're quite generically very similar. So a Honda looks like a Toyota and a Toyota looks like a Mercedes and a Mercedes looks like a BMW and a BMW looks like an Aston Martin. They've got that basic genetic lines that follow this pattern of education from engineering schools that say, well, we really want you to think out of the box, but don't think out of the box.
Yeah.
Because if you think out of the box, you won't get a job. And if you don't get a job, you won't feed the family. So the young inspiring designer turns around and says, well, I better not rock the boat because if I rock the boat, I'll be ostracized and they'll class me the black sheep, you know?
Right.
I mean, they're my thoughts. I mean, I don't know where we're going in the future with design of cars. Certainly nothing like what we've seen in the 50s, 60s and 70s, mate.
Right.
My God, you know, fins and chrome and steel and color and white wall tires and noise and we ain't got any of that shit anymore, you know.
George, I love the passion that just comes through you as you talk. I feel like my dad would love you. My dad has a 65 Impala that he completely restored, and I got to drive it recently. So I feel like I would love to get you two guys in a room together. It would be like chaos. But
well, the thing that scares me about you, Scott, is you live in New York, so you probably ride around on a bloody bicycle, mate.
I'm in Jersey. Yeah, I'm in Jersey. We're on New York time, but I'm in Jersey. George, we'd love to have you on again down the line, talk about all sorts of crap, guns and everything else you're into. But our time is coming to an end here. So what is on the horizon for George? And if people want to check out all your work and what's going on and kind of what you're up to, where should they go?
Well, look, thanks for giving me a plug, so to speak. You know, people can catch me on Facebook because I try to go live from racetracks. Facebook's probably the easiest one for me because I'm constantly on it like a teenager. also on my Instagram, and they're both in my name, George Vidovic, you know, is my Facebook and George Vidovic is my Instagram.
Right.
Our future is we're hitting the road 8th of April. We're going to be racing at Pahrump, Nevada. Then we're off to Birmingham, Alabama. We're going to be racing at the Barber Motorsport. And crazy as it seems, we were invited by George Barber, who owns the Motorsport Museum, for a personal tour of the Motorsport Museum because I ended up giving him a book. Now, just hold your horses. Hold your horses. I wrote a book.
All right.
It's called, I forgot what it's bloody, Pride, Passion, and Persistence, One Man's Automotive Dream.
Awesome.
I actually gave that book to George Barber, and I got a phone call from him at Sebring moment. So he's going to take us for a tour there. Then from Sebring, we go to Lime Rock, Connecticut. From Lime Rock, Connecticut, we head over back to Portland, and we race in Portland, Sonoma. Then from Portland, we go to Laguna Seca. Laguna Seca, we go to Coda in Texas. From Texas, we end up going to Sebring, and we're going to finish the season in Sebring. But stay tuned there because we're going to end up doing – we've entered the 12-hour with our car. So we're going to do the 12-hour of Sebring in our car, and I'm pumped for that, and I'm really excited. But my book, I don't know where you can get it, but I've got copies of it. Anyone who wants a copy can come to a racetrack and buy it off me, mate. Good on you, guys.
Yeah. The only problem is they have to Zoom you in order to get the book, and it's becoming
come to a racetrack, and they can sit in my car. Let them take photos of the car. We've got posters, so they're all more than welcome. You know, I'll post my schedule on the Facebook, and they can have a look at our schedule there. So if they're at the track, if they mention verbal shenanigans, I'll give them a free poster and a free decal for their car.
All right.
And so that gives your viewers or your podcast listeners a chance to get free, so to speak,
merch, swag. George, thank you so much, man. Stay safe out there. Keep doing awesome stuff. Really enjoyed having you on.
Thanks, mate. And anytime, guys. I appreciate you. Thank you very much.
George Vidovic, Mike. George Vidovic. How does it make your car feel? Like, the morning after that interview, I got in my car. I'm like, my car sucks compared to,
Yeah. You hear about, how he's talking about, man, I'm going, 190, 200 down and in these turns and all. I get into my Honda CR-V. I'm just like, I don't feel like a guy anymore right now.
It doesn't feel like it has the lines or the curves. He's right, though. Cars definitely do not have that same kind of soul they used to.
No, they all look to be mass-produced and, in squares and make sure it has USB ports. And you're never going to get, a quality, wow, I'm going to get this car and I want to pass it down to my son. Kind of car.
Yeah. What was your first car?
Pontiac Grand Am, 86.
86. I also had an 86.
Yep. It was powder blue on the outside.
Woo!
I remember, the big thing I remember was the material on the top of the ceiling. I guess, the glue was old or something like that, so it came down, so there was a big bubble and it was laying on top of my head.
Those 80s 90s American cars were terrible. Every car you got in, the ceiling was falling down, and the rugs on the where your feet would be all peeling up and
easily.
I had an 86 Chrysler Laser.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. It was my grandfather's car, and he died. And
I was hoping, are you the reason why he died? You're like, that car is too cool. It's mine, and you stabbed him?
It would be even worse if, like, the laser was the reason he died, and I was like, I'll take that, you know, like some kind of... So my dad... So talk about fair. So the old joke in my house was that my brother Tim was always the favorite child, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my brother, my dad bought him an 80-something Camaro, which he wanted, right? And it had the T-tops and everything. And they, like, completely restored it. And this Camaro is badass sports car, right? So he gets this car. He drives it. That's exactly what he wanted. I, on the other hand, had to get my license later in life. And it was a big sticking point in my family because something with insurance reasons, if you had someone under the age of 17 for that period of time, their insurance would have, like, doubled. So there was, like, a 4 or 5 month waiting period. And when you're a kid, the only thing you care about in your life is getting your license, right? 17 years old, that is the thing. That's the only thing you on your mind.
Oh, yeah. I think I brought this up on the podcast before, but, like, as I was going in for my license, I had my permit at the time, but I had, like, really bad acne in high school. So, like, they were giving me, like, these, like, crazy super pills that, like, supposed to, like, dry up your skin to the point of craziness. And it dried up.
Is that what it said on the bottle? We'll dry your skin to the point of craziness.
I don't know why we went to that back alley to get some zit medication, but we did. But it dried up my skin and my pores, everything so much. It dried up the liquids in my eye. So when I went to, like, do, like, the eye chart test, like, with the one eye, I couldn't get past the second line.
No.
Yeah. And there was a point where they're like, well, we really can't pass you for this. And I'm like, I'm not a popular kid to begin with. So I'm saying, all right, my choices are having horrible acne and driving where it's not going to do me any good, or having clear skin and not being able to drive. Thank you, high school. This is wonderful moments that will go around for my entire life.
So did you have to wait a little bit?
Well, but basically we called up the doctors and they said, well, you know, yeah, you're getting some crazy reaction. Get off the pills. And then, like, after a couple of days, my vision came back a lot
but
better.
Still, that day of getting your license is what every kid dreams about. Like, I could drive. And I got robbed of that. So now my brother got this Camaro, beautiful sports car, probably got like 3 miles to the gallon, you know. So I'm like, what is my dad going to do for me? Is he going to give me like a pickup truck, something I like? He's like, well, you can have grandpa's car. And I'm like, okay. And it's a Chrysler Laser, and it has the back window that is probably 4 feet by 4 feet. It's a giant square. And he's like, don't worry, I'll customize it. And he, like, paints it nicely blue, which was cool. He cut a sunroof into the car. I remember I had to pick out hubcaps, and I picked out, like, nice hubcaps that looked like rims, and we put a beautiful car stereo. Remember the stereos with, like, the graphics in them? Like,
mm-hmm.
There was, like, I think there was one option to have, like, a dolphin swimming on it or whatever. So I get the car way later than I'm supposed to. And I drive it to a high school basketball game. Go watch the basketball game. Come out. Stereo is gone. Robbed right out of the car. I didn't take my little... I didn't take the head off of it and put it in the little case, you know?
Yeah, that's what I had. I was smart, you know.
I wasn't.
I knew those robbers were looking for it.
I was not smart. They robbed me blind. Then one day I'm driving, I pull into my driveway, and the next day go to get in my car, the car would not go in reverse. Like, it just stopped going in reverse. And it was just kind of a disaster car. I was dating a girl in college. I still had that car, and she had a driveway in Chester, New Jersey, where you lived, that was really, really steep. And I remember the first time I go to meet her parents, I'm chugging up trying to get up this driveway with this Chrysler Laser, and it starts just spewing smoke, like poof, poof. So I show up like, here's my boyfriend Scott, and there's just gray smoke billowing out of the car. They had some money too. They were probably like, oh my God, like this guy is not the right guy for my daughter. But yeah, man, like I don't know, man. What was funny though about my brother's situation, so he had the Camaro, really cool car, right? Then he went to college, and my dad was working for BMW, and that's where he retired at BMW. He worked on the cars at the port. So they had a lease program where you can get a brand new BMW for like really cheap. So they offered my brother, would you rather go to college your senior year, you know, stay at Rutgers University, or you can commute, because we were only about 15 miles away or whatever, and you can drive a BMW. My brother took the BMW deal, okay? So mm-hmm. he drove the BMW for a year. He was probably like the man. but then college ended, and that lease had to be turned in. So my brother went from driving a BMW to graduating college to then he had no car, and he got the family caravan after that.
Oh.
So if he had any girls in mind, they probably thought he was killing it, and then he got like a DUI or something, and now he has to drive this car. And I remember he worked at a pool at the time, and he had to carry all these chemicals in the back, and like they'd burn the seats. Like, so he went to from like a maybe, oh, let me think, like a 99 brand new BMW to like an 86 blue caravan that's been traveling by a family like 100 times, like puking on road trips, going on vacation, all that.
See, that's where you got to get your story ready, where you, if you're like dating some girl, it's like, listen, you know, I got this guy carjacked me out of nowhere. There was like these five gang members that came out, and they right. had like chains swirling, and I took three of them down, but one of them sucker punched me and they took off. And needless to say, the insurance could only get me this in the meantime and all, but don't you worry.
Yeah. Beamer's
once the insurance goes through, I'm going to have that BMW back, baby doll.
Beamer's come back, baby. So, yeah, that deal failed. And I always make fun of him. Like, you took a year off of college, staying at college your senior year for a car. I'm like, you missed. You really got sold on that one. What was what was your favorite car?
I was never, like, a big car guy, so I never really cared. It was more like just getting from point A to point B.
Did you ever have a car that you just loved? Like, you're like, this is my car. Like, you were sad to see it go when you got rid of it.
Not really. I mean,
nah, I hated all my cars.
Yeah, like, I didn't hate them. Like, the what was the one I had before? The silver one. Was it a Honda, I want to say?
The hearse?
No. It's like a... You remember my silver car? I don't even remember the brand and all. I guess I like that one. I paid it off and I had like another 4 years from it. I'm the one that was ride it to the grave.
That is my dream, to never have a car payment again. But yet I keep getting into leases, and it's probably never going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way I am. And like, I know people say like, well, you should really trade it in after you pay it off because you get a good chunk off and blah blah blah. It's like, nah, they all rip you off, and once I'm done with payments, I just let it go. And then one day it's like, and the clutch ain't working like it used to. Let me sell for like a grand.
Now I'm driving my car the car that I would never think I would have, which is like a Jeep Gladiator, and I love it so much. But my favorite car ever was my 92 Ford Ranger. It was this little pickup I found on the street. It was like $1,800. It lasted so – it was the best car in the snow ever for some reason. And I did donuts in that. And, like, we used to go to the Kmart parking lot in the snow and drive around as fast as possible and, like, pull the e-brake. Like, I couldn't even imagine doing that right now. I'd be too scared my car is going to flip.
Random funny story. When I was on my learner's permit, it snowed one day where school was canceled. And my dad's like, I want to take you out and – so you can learn like snow driving. And when we were in a parking lot, he told me to do that. He's like, all right, I want you to speed up.
Yes.
Okay. I want you to pull the emergency brake. Okay. Or hit the brake or whatever. And we skidded a little. And he's like, what did you learn? I literally looked at him like, I learned you think I'm stupid enough to think that was a smart idea, Dad. I don't know what to tell you. And
you're like, drifting is awesome. You know, like.
Tokyo Drift forever.
But yeah, my Ranger was the best little car. And it was like to the point where I drove it for a while. And then towards the end, the transmission wasn't working anymore. So I would accelerate to like 25 and it would start redlining. It'd be like, so I'd have to, it was like having a stick shift with an automatic. So you'd have to let off and let it drop and then hit the gas again and go to like 45, let the gas off, falling apart. At one point I was coming home from college. It was my last year of college. I'm driving. All of a sudden I hear poof. I'm like, what the hell was that? I think I ran. I look in the back, the rear view mirror, and I see a muffler. I'm like, oh my God, I ran over someone's muffler. It was my muffler that I ran over, and it exploded my tire. So we patched the tire. My dad puts the muffler back on. I put the car for sale. We sold it to some Mexican guy. He was like, oh, is this a good truck? We're like, totally good truck. Lasts a long time. He bought it for $100 less than I paid for it 4 years later.
Wow.
Yep. I missed that really? Little Ford Ranger.
Aw. Poor Scotty, you know, just sitting in his bed at night, twiddling his thumbs, can't go to sleep. And Alex is like, you okay? Somewhere my Ford Ranger's out there.
Thinking about the Ranger. How many cars have you had?
One, two. Five or six.
Yeah, I had five.
I think of my time.
I had five.
Like I said, I mean, I'm one of those ride it till it dies, then just go out and get whatever one that's like, all right, I can afford that.
Yeah.
I mean, cars has never been my thing, as in, man, I want to get the most tricked out thing, this or that. I'm just like, give me the point A to point B.
Now, are you a speed guy? Are you okay with like high speed?
I mean, I don't do a ton of speeding anyway. I mean, it's nothing where I'm like, I need that.
George is like, I want to kill this guy. No speed. Doesn't care what his car is. He doesn't like you right now.
Well, I mean, we got 70 mile an hour speed limits down here, and I mean, most of the time when you're in 70, you got to go minimum 80 or else you're going to get run over. So,
yeah.
I mean, my car goes okay. I remember I was with a guy and he was, he was trying to buy a car. And remember the Geos? Those like little small cars?
Yep.
I remember we went for a test drive with the guy and this salesman's trying to say, you're going to love this, man. You're going to love the features in it. And he's like, I want to take you to this like big hill to show you what it's about. It's like, okay. So we come to the hill and he starts driving up and you can tell like the car is struggling. And we're like, well, what's the big deal? He's like, you see that little button by the transmission? Just push on it. And that's a surge button where it gives it like extra power. And I'm kind of looking at him like, you know, most cars don't have that. They just have a regular engine.
Yeah, they just get up the hill. Yeah,
like he was like so ready to impress us with the surge button on this crappy ass Geo that like he thought we were like, man, look at this go. Every time I press a button, we can get up a hill.
That's awesome. Well, Berlo, it's time to go. Anything to promote before we get the hell out of here?
I will promote my sister, Dawn Smethy. She is working for our ERA Central Realty Group down in Southern Jersey. She's a very wonderful woman. She's been in the biz for 5-6 years, been able to help out a bunch of people in the Jersey area. She's in Cream Ridge, New Jersey, and offers the high quality service and give them the time and respect they deserve. If you're looking for a home, you can check out my sister, Dawn Smethy, at DSMETHY at ERACentral.com.
So go check out Mike's sister.
You know what I mean by
that to come out.
She's a married woman. How dare you?
And I will just promote comedy's coming back a little bit. Two Verbal Shenanigans shows, May 20th at Tap House 15. $45 prefix menu. So we're doing something a little bit different. You get a great meal, great show for $45. Please, comics haven't been working for basically a year. And then May 22nd here at Indian Lake in Denville. Another great show, $25 for an entry fee. Outdoors, socially distanced, all that stuff. So guys, I want to thank George for coming on the show. And if you want to listen to us, please check us out on Spotify, on Podbean, on the Apple Podcast app, Google Play, a million different things, BS Podcast Network. We're all over the place. And the best thing you can do is leave a review for us, because that really helps us get populated. Other than that, guys, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
Burlew's Bear Barbecue coming this summer.
Spicy bears. My old man, he kicked me out. He kicked me out when I told him that I live this way. 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 He doesn't own me. He doesn't own me. He doesn't own me. He doesn't own me. Just escape. Arrows land for falling. Arrows for falling. Arrows land for falling. Arrows for falling. The black rims that line your face like a deer drinking.